attention and called, "Juvenile prisoner number 725 requests toilet permission." When she got back, she stood to attention again. "Juvenile prisoner number 725 requests permission to resume." Before going to lunch, they were counted. After lunch, they were marched around a yard for exercise, and then counted again. The prisoners were counted and recounted from the moment they woke to the moment they went to sleep. And, as Miriam says, chuckling, "You know what? The numbers were always right. Everyone was always there." Prison left me with some strange little tics. She has taken all the doors off their hinges in all the apartments she has lived in since. It's not that she has anxiety attacks about small spaces, she says. It's just that she starts to sweat and go cold. "This apartment is perfect for me," she says, looking around the open space. "How about elevators?" I ask, recalling the schlep up the stairs. "Exactly," she replies. "I don't like them much either." One day, years later, her husband Charlie was fooling around at home, playing the guitar. Miriam said something provocative and he stood up suddenly, lifting his arm up to take off the guitar strap. He was probably just going to say, "That's outrageous," or tickle her or tackle her. But she was gone. She was already down in the courtyard of the building. She does not remember getting down the stairs. It was an automatic flight reaction. Charlie came out to coax her back up. He was distraught. She surprised them both with her tics in the first years they were together. All of a sudden, I am very tired, as though my bones have gone soft. I look up, and it is dark outside. I want someone to give her a rub. I want someone to give me a rub. I want the benevolent prison governess of TV Land to have existed. I want the lesbian with the heart of gold to have protected the little girl, and I think of what is still to come. When Miriam was released in 1970, she was 17 and a half. Her sister took her to a lake to bathe. The lifesaver asked her out, but she was unable to respond. His name was Karl-Heinz Weber, but everyone called him Charlie. When Miriam didn't answer, he pursued her through her sister. He thought she was so odd and so quiet. He wanted to get to the bottom of it. "What were you like?" I ask her. "Well, you'd really need to ask him that," she says. "He was the one who brought me round again." Miriam crosses the room to a worn suitcase, which spills her photographs onto the floor. She finds one of Charlie. It is of a man in his 20s, with light brown hair and a neat face, looking straight at the camera. He is positioned oddly close to the left-hand edge of the photo. "Oh, that's because I cut myself out of it," Miriam says. Then she says, "That was our wedding photo." I want to ask, but I sit tight. Miriam and Charlie moved in together. Charlie had trained as a sports teacher, studying physical education and biology. In the GDR, sport was closely linked with politics. The government screened youngsters for their potential and fed them into training institutes for the glory of the nation. Did he know about the doping? Children at sports schools were given hormones under the guise of vitamins. In a scandal that has come to light since the wall fell, the pills accelerated growth and strength, but turned the little girls halfway into boys. "Yes, he knew from two different people about that. I remember he once told friends of ours to keep their daughter out of one of those institutes, but that wasn't why he left teaching." In his early 20s, Charlie and a friend holidayed up on the Baltic Sea. When a Swedish boat came near the coast, they decided to swim out to it, just to see how far they could get.
"I don't think they wanted to board it or anything," she says. "It was a bit provocative, but it was just a game."
The authorities brought them in on suspicion of wanting to leave the country. That was the beginning of Charlie Weber's pursuit by the Stasi. Charlie didn't feel that he could represent to his students the state that was doing this to him. He left teaching and started to write. He wrote articles for the magazine Eulenspiegel and treatments for television programs. He had jobs as a line producer on films and some work in the theatre. He wrote a small book, Miriam says, called Gestern wie heute, Yesterday Like Today, about the way that one dictatorship here is the same as another. He sent it to West Germany, where it was published. After we started living together, me an ex-criminal and he under surveillance, they would come over and search the house from time to time, she says. When our neighbour, an old woman, saw this happening, she offered to keep a trunk of our books and Charlie's manuscripts at her place, because they'd never suspect her. We made some mistakes, though. I remember one time they were here, young blokes going through all our drawers, everything on the desks, the record collection. One of them was up a ladder searching the bookshelves when he found Orwell's Animal Farm, which, of course, was blacklisted. We held our breath as he pulled it off the shelf. I remember the cover clearly. It was the pigs holding a red flag aloft. We watched as this young man looked at it, the pigs and the flag. Then he put it back. Afterwards we laughed. We could only think that he saw the pigs, that was bad, but that they were holding a red flag, and they seemed to be on a collective farm. He must have thought that meant it was all right. I was prohibited from studying, and I couldn't get any kind of job at all, Miriam says. Everything I applied for, the Stasi made sure I was turned down. Employers had to check my personal files, and the instruction was always, not her. I used to take a lot of photographs. Eventually, all I could do was send them to magazines with friends' names on them, and my friends would pass on the money they got for my work. She ruffles her hair. In a way, though, how we lived was quite good. We didn't have to submit ourselves to the sorts of structures and authority that we couldn't trust here. We managed. In 1979, Miriam's sister and her husband tried to escape to West Germany, concealed in the boot of a car. Charlie drove them to meet the courier who was to smuggle them over the border. The Stasi followed every move. The couple received prison terms, and Charlie was placed on a type of probation. In September 1980, the West German Chancellor, Helmut Schmidt, was scheduled to visit the GDR. At that time, the Solidarity movement in Poland was a source of tension for Eastern Bloc governments because it was a focus of hope for many under their rule. Then Schmidt's visit was cancelled because of East German government concern that it would lead to demonstrations for democracy in front of the Western television cameras. Nevertheless, the East German authorities had prepared for the visit. They had rounded up and locked away anyone who might protest or might in some way embarrass the government. By this time, Charlie stood under formal suspicion of the crime of attempting to flee the Republic. He and Miriam had put in applications to leave the GDR. Such applications were sometimes granted, because the GDR, unlike any other Eastern European country, could rid itself of malcontents by ditching them into West Germany, where they were automatically welcomed as citizens. The Stasi put all applicants under extreme scrutiny. People who applied to leave were, unsurprisingly, suspected of wanting to leave, which was, other than by this long-winded and arbitrary process, a crime. An application to leave was legal, but the authorities might, if the fancy took them, choose to see it as a statement of why you didn't like the GDR. In that case, it became a Hetzschrift, a smear, or a Schmarschrift, a libel, and therefore a criminal offence. On the 26th of August 1980, Charlie Weber was arrested and held in a remand cell. At first, Miriam's only contact with him was by letter. She was permitted no visit, and he could not call. Eventually, a half-hour visit was scheduled for Tuesday, the 14th of October. The day before, Miriam's most recent letter to Charlie came back to her, marked in handwriting, "Postal permission terminated." With it, there was a Stasi card in the letterbox. "Visit authorization for 14/10/1980 withdrawn." On Wednesday, the 15th of October, an ordinary policeman in his green uniform knocked on their apartment door.
Is this the house of Herr Weber?
Yes.
And you are Frau Weber?
Yes.
Well, you need to report to the district attorney's office and collect your husband's things, because he is dead.
He was gone before Miriam could find any words. The German Democratic Republic paid lip service to the institutions of democracy. There were district attorneys, whose job it was to administer justice, and lawyers, whose job it was to represent clients, and judges, whose job it was to pass judgment. There were, at least on paper, political parties other than the ruling Socialist Unity Party. But really, there was just the party and its instrument, the Stasi. Judges often got their instructions from the Stasi, which, in turn, passed them on from the party, right down to the outcome of judgment and the length of the sentence. The connection of the party, the Stasi, and the law went from the ground up. The Stasi, in consultation with school principals, recruited obedient students with an appropriately loyal attitude for the study of law. I once saw a list of dissertation topics from the Stasi Law School at Potsdam, which included such memorable contributions to the sum of human knowledge as on the probable causes of the psychological pathology of the desire to commit border infractions. There was no room for a person to defend themselves against the state, because all the defense lawyers and all the judges were part of it. Miriam went to Major Trost, the district attorney who was responsible for investigating Charlie's death. Trost told her Charlie had hanged himself. Trost said he was very sorry. In fact, they were all deeply, deeply shocked. He said he had been called to the cell immediately. Miriam asked what Charlie had hanged himself with. What had he hanged himself from?
"I know those cells," she tells me. "There are no exposed pipes. Everything is smooth inside. There are not even bars over the windows. They are too small."
Trost said he didn't know.
"But you were called to the cell. How can you not know? You must have seen what a man is hanging from."
"No."
Miriam shakes her head, imitating his dismissiveness.
"Well, what with then?"
She would not give up. That day, Trost told her Charlie had hanged himself with the elastic from the waistband of his trousers. Miriam didn't believe it. She kept going back to his office and kept asking. They were being surprisingly gentle with her. Trost's deputy told her Charlie had hanged himself with his underwear. Another time, Trost said it was a torn-up piece of bedsheet. She confronted him.
"Underwear or bedsheet? Underwear or bedsheet? The least you people could do is get your story straight."
Major Trost lost his cool. He said if she didn't leave the room, he would have her arrested. Miriam found out Charlie's body was being held in forensics at the morgue. She went there, but no one would let her in. She felt she was being followed. She went to see Charlie's lawyer, Herr X, who was the Leipzig representative for Dr. Wolfgang Vogel in Berlin. Vogel was the government lawyer responsible for trade in people between East and West Germany. He ran a list of names and negotiated with the West German government the prices at which they would be, as it was called, bought free. Freigekauft. There was a scale of prices which varied, apparently, according to the education of the person being bought. A tradesperson or clerical worker came more cheaply than someone with a doctorate. The exception was for clergy. A pastor cost nothing, because they were often independent anti-regime thinkers, and it was worth it to the regime to be rid of them. For East Germany, trading in humans was a source of hard currency, and at the same time a means of getting rid of those who would not conform. One way of getting onto Vogel's list, and thereby having a chance of getting out of the GDR, was to become a client of one of his regional representatives. That is why Charlie Weber had engaged X. By the time Miriam went to see him, X had had the Weber matter, now the investigation of a death in custody, for 8 weeks. Miriam sat down in his office and asked him to tell her what he had found out. When he opened his file on the desk, it contained only a single sheet of paper. the delegated authority from Fergal to take on the case. Instead of telling her anything, he asked,
"Mrs. Weber, why don't you tell me what you know?"
Miriam was wild. For days, she said, she had experienced the kind of anger that makes you not care any more, say things you would usually put a brake on. She replied that it was his job to investigate, so he should really be finding out and telling her. If he had done nothing for Charlie while he was in prison, she said, he could at least find out how he died.
"Do I look insane to you?" the lawyer said, very cold. "Do I? You don't truly think I'm going to trot down there and ask what happened, do you? For that you had better find yourself another fool, young lady."
Miriam is upset again. Here, across the desk, was the face of the system itself, a mockery of a lawyer making a mockery of her. On Tuesday, the 21st of October, 1980, a Stasi man came to the door to tell Miriam that the corpse had been released from forensics and that the ministry would like to be of service to her with the funeral arrangements. Miriam said she could manage on her own.
"Of course, Mrs. Weber," the man said, "but do you have a particular funeral parlour in mind?"
She told him to go to hell and found a smallish funeral establishment. The woman behind the desk was old and kind. She said,
"You know, Mrs. Weber, you would really be better off going to the Southern Cemetery, because they will organize the whole thing from start to finish, and fill in all the forms on your behalf and so on. It would mean much less running around for you."
Miriam didn't think anything of it. She left and went to the Southern Cemetery offices. She knocked on the door and was told to come in.
"You're late. We were expecting you earlier,"
the man behind the desk said.
"What? Who told you I was coming? I didn't know myself I was coming here until half an hour ago."
I don't know. I don't remember."
First of all, he suggested cremation instead of burial. Miriam said no. Well, actually, they said it was going to have to be cremation because they had no coffins left. Miriam bluffed.
"I will bring you a coffin."
The man left the room for a moment, then reappeared.
"Today, Mrs. Weber," he said, "is your lucky day. We have one last coffin left."
Unfortunately, however, he added, it was not going to be possible to lay out the body for mourners to pay their last respects. He gave no reason.
"If that's the way it is," Miriam said, "I'm going to another funeral establishment and another cemetery." "No, no, no, Mrs. Weber, no need for that. We'll see what we can do about a laying out, then."
The day before the funeral, Miriam and a friend took some of the wreaths she had received to the gravesite. There were too many to carry them all the next day. She noticed a fellow standing around, smoking, doing nothing much, watching. A woman in the uniform of a cemetery official came up to her.
"Are you with the Weber funeral?"
"Yes."
"Well, I just wanted to say, don't you get too upset tomorrow if there's no laying out, because it may just be that there isn't."
Miriam got her in full view, the smoker within earshot.
"Let me tell you now, if there is no laying out, there will be no funeral. I will call the whole thing off with everyone standing around here. I will make the kind of ruckus you have never seen. Do you understand me?"
The next day, there was a laying out. Miriam says the coffin was far away, behind a thick pane of glass, and the whole thing was lit from below with purple neon light.
"Even in that terrible light, I could still see his head injuries, and I could see his neck. They'd forgotten to cover it up. There were no strangulation marks, nothing."
She looks across at me.
"You'd think they would make sure to cover his neck if they wanted to stick with their story that he hanged himself, wouldn't you?"
From there, the coffin was sunk to another level and reappeared on a trolley wheeled by cemetery employees to the gravesite. All these details are slowed down in time, stuck in the amber of memory. In the minutes between the coffin sinking from view and re-emerging, she says, there would have been time for a body to be taken out. A great many people were at the funeral, Miriam tells me, but I think there were even more Stasi there. There was a van with long-range antennae for sound recording equipment parked at the gates. There were men in the bushes with telephoto lenses. Everywhere you looked, there were men with walkie-talkies. At the cemetery offices, building work was going on. Stasi agents sat in pairs in the scaffolding. Everyone, every single one of us was photographed, and you could see in advance the path the procession was to take from the chapel to the grave. It was marked at regular intervals all along by the Stasi men, just standing around. When they reached the grave, there were two of them sitting there on a trestle, ready to watch the whole thing. As soon as the last person threw on their flowers, Miriam says, the cemetery people started piling on the earth, and it was too quick. It was just too quick. Miriam walks barefoot across the room to a desk and picks up some papers in a plastic sheath. I made a copy of this for you, she says, coming back to the table. It is part of the Stasi file on Charlie Weber, a handwritten report signed by a Major Mahler. In it, all the divisional plans are set out for the organization and surveillance of the Weber funeral. Miriam's telephone is to be tapped. She is to be called in for a clarification of circumstances the day before. Sound recording technology is to be used at the site. A photographic documentation of the event is to be made. Citizens of the Federal Republic of Germany attending the funeral are to be supervised to ensure they leave the GDR before curfew at the end of the day. The name of the pastor who will conduct the service regrettably could not be ascertained by this operative. Should negative enemy behavior occur during the funeral, all men are given orders to use force to quell it, on the grounds that such actions would contravene the dignity of the cemetery premises. Major Mahler noted that the head of the Southern Cemetery, a Herr Maurer, had guaranteed the Stasi complete freedom of movement for the Weber action, and that should any of the Stasi officers be questioned by workers at the cemetery, they should be referred to colleague Maurer. Maurer knows that Mahler is an officer of the Stasi, and also knows him by his true name, not his undercover identity. All of this Miriam could have guessed from what she saw on the day. She points to the next line and reads it aloud. No definitive information is available as to the date for the cremation. This date can be ascertained from colleague Maurer on or after 31-10-80. Miriam hands the file to me. On the 30th of October, we buried a coffin. We buried a coffin, and they are setting the date for cremation the next day. Either there is no one inside that thing, or there is someone else in it. Miriam went to the Interior Ministry and added the claim of transportation of coffin to her application to leave the GDR. She wanted to get out, and she wanted to rebury Charlie in West Germany. Every month or so she would be called into the Stasi for a chat. It went on for years. "What's all this about transportation of the coffin?" they asked her. "What do you want with the coffin?" "What do you think I want with the coffin? To take it for a Sunday stroll? I want to do with the coffin what one does with a coffin. I want to bury it." In 1985 they said to her, "You probably want to have the contents examined, don't you?" "What if I do? What am I likely to find other than that he hanged himself, as you say?" "You know there will be nothing left in the coffin. You won't be able to prove anything." "Well, why are you so preoccupied with it, then?" she said, and took it as an admission of guilt. After a time, Miriam stopped obeying the cards that appeared in her letterbox, summoning her to their offices to clarify some circumstances. The only thing that ever got clearer was that they had the power in the circumstances. It was silly. I stopped thinking I'd ever get out. They were playing with me like a mouse. At 8 a.m. one morning in May 1989, Miriam's phone rang. It was the Stasi. They couldn't say why, but she was required to report to them without delay, this day, and bring her identity papers. Miriam thought if it wasn't cards in her letterbox summoning her to clarify circumstances, they were giving her wake-up calls. She had had a late night. She slept some more, then got up and had a shower, made the first cup of tea. At midday the doorbell sounded. A Stasi man, Division of the Interior.
"Why are you still here?"
he said.
"This is my home." You are required to report immediately to the Ministry and bring your identity papers with you.
There's plenty of time. The day is still long, my friend. He stationed himself outside her door. She went down to the offices. An official took her ID papers and said she was to go to a photographer, and that after that she had an appointment with a public notary. Then she was to come back to collect her travel authority.
You were on a train tonight,
he said. That was when I understood, Miriam says.
I was in shock. I said to them, it's been 11 years since we lodged the application to leave, and now I can't even say goodbye to my friends. Mrs. Weber, the travel authority you have been issued is valid until midnight tonight. If you are found to be on GDR territory after that time, you will be here illegally, and you will be arrested. I would remind you, he said, holding them up to her in his hand, that you no longer have any identity papers for this country.
The train that night was crammed full of people being expelled from the GDR. It was as though anyone who might catch the Glasnost virus had to be put over the wall. Miriam had a small carry bag with two changes of clothes in it, and she was leaving her life behind. Her friends were going to pack up her apartment for her. For all she knew, she would never be back. No one had any idea that the wall would fall that November.
Essentially, the deportation came 11 years too late, she says, and 6 months too early.
Night has fallen, and the city lights are spread out beneath us. In the dark, this could be any city, in any normal place. Some people are comfortable talking about their lives, as if they can make sense of the progression of random events that made them what they are. This involves a kind of forward-looking faith in life, a conviction that cause and effect are linked, and that they are themselves more than the sum of their past. For Miriam, the past stopped when Charlie died. Her memories of picnics or cooking meals or holidays, her real life are memories where she is a we, and those are the things she and Charlie did together. It is as if the time after his death doesn't count. It has been a non-time, laying down non-history. She is brave and strong and broken all at once. As she speaks, it is as if her existence is no longer real to her in itself, more like a living epitaph to a life that was. Why did you come back to Leipzig? I ask.
Well, in this matter I've got going at the moment, it is better that I am here. It only takes me an hour to get to the offices of the investigators in Dresden.
She smiles. And I am hoping, she says, and I see that under the smile she is fighting back tears.
I am really hoping that the puzzle women in Nuremberg find out something about Charlie in all those pieces of files.
Miriam wants Charlie's body exhumed, so she can know for sure what happened to him. I look out at the lights. She continues,
I don't believe he would have killed himself. I don't think he did. Of the two of us, he was always more worried it would be me who would crack under all that pressure.
Not knowing what happened to Charlie is so hard, because if it was suicide, she was abandoned. I wonder what will happen to her when they dig up the coffin. If he was cremated, there will be nothing there, or someone else's remains. If it's Charlie, what could that tell her? Will she be released into a new life, or will the current one lose its purpose? Miriam can't afford to have the exhumation performed privately, so she hopes it'll be done in the course of the criminal investigation into his death that is now, apparently, being undertaken by the authorities of United Germany. but twice they have tried to suspend the investigation, and twice she has travelled to Dresden to bang on their desks. You know, they just want to stop thinking about the past. They want to pretend it all didn't happen. Most recently, the DA wrote to Miriam, saying that the investigation was to be suspended because a former employee of the Southern Cemetery had credibly assured him that there had been nothing untoward about the Weber funeral. She sent him in the file, highlighting the parts that referred to the body coming from anatomy, code for the Stasi mortuary, as if somehow the corpses coming from custody were coming from the medical school. The surveillance detail for the funeral, the part about Herr Maurer knowing the true identity of the Stasi man who was making arrangements with him, and the part about the cremation scheduled to take place the next day. "That stopped them," she says. I wrote, "Do you still think there was nothing untoward about the Weber funeral?" The DA replied that he hadn't yet read that section of the file. When Miriam inquired at the Stasi file authority, she found that he hadn't even lodged a request to see it. "Do you ever run into any Stasi men you recognize in the street?" I ask. I think that is what would terrify me, in the nonsensical way in which it is horrible to run into someone who has wronged you. "No, thank goodness. But I did try to find the people involved in Charlie's case." Shortly after the revolution in 1989, Miriam went to the cemetery to find Herr Maurer, but he had vanished as soon as the wall came down. "The Stasi cremated a lot of people at the Southern Cemetery," she says. Miriam did find Major Mahler. She rang him and said she would like to meet to discuss the Weber case. They met in a cafe. Miriam took a friend along so she would have a witness. The friend sat at the next table, unknown to Mahler. Mahler said he didn't know anything.
"No, the name Weber doesn't say anything to me."
"Well, why did you come here, then?" Miriam asked.
I just wanted to see what you wanted."
"But I told you on the phone that what I wanted was to talk about the Weber matter."
"Oh, I thought you were going to tell me something."
Did he want to know how much she knew, whether he was going to be uncovered, or whether he was to be blackmailed?
"It is amazing," Miriam says, "what a revolution can do to people's memories."
A cloud of smoke covers her head and the high back of the chair. "There are some compensations, though, for being here. This apartment, for one," she says, and she's right. A siren wails past and subsides. She is a maiden, safe in her tower. "And I think about those Stasi men. They would never in their lives have imagined that they would cease to exist and that their offices would be a museum. A museum!" She shakes her head and butts out her cigarette. "That's one thing I love to do. I love to drive up to the Runde Ecke and park right outside. I just sit there in the car and I feel triumph." Miriam makes a gesture which starts as a wave and becomes a guillotine. "You lot are gone." Chapter 5. The Linoleum Palace. It's past midnight when I get back to Berlin. I've been on a tram, a regional train, the local line, and then walked through the park where things are only shapes, dark on dark. Miriam's story has winded me. My head, no longer consumed by listening, started to pulse again as soon as I left her apartment. I dislike being made aware that my heart is just a small pump, pushing all that blood around. I am beyond tired. As I reach my place, I'm in slow motion, crossing a finishing line. My building is covered in grey, sprayed-on concrete, but still has grand arched doors at its entrance. At the end of the carriage hall, a matching set of doors leads into the yard, with its chestnut tree and weedy cobbles. I live on the first floor, past the letterboxes, up the stairs on the right. I don't check the mail, but turn on the hall light and go straight up. The stairwell walls are covered in bright but inscrutable spray can graffiti, which could be expressions of joy or pain, depending on how you look at them. But I don't. I hurry to get my key in the lock before the hall bulb goes off its automatic timer. Home free. Home safe. Inside, the lights are on. A voice shrieks.
Don't be frightened! Don't be frightened!
I'm terrified.
Sorry! Sorry!
Says the voice. The pump in my chest pumps hard. I drop my pack. A woman up a ladder holds a large screwdriver. It's Julia, from whom I rent.
I'm really sorry,
she says, turning towards me and lowering the screwdriver.
That's okay,
I say slowly, puffed.
I know exactly how it is, she says. Sometimes you just want to get home and be by yourself.
That would probably be, I think, because I live by myself. But I don't say anything.
I'm just unscrewing here, she says. I'm taking these bookshelves. I hope you don't mind.
I don't mind.
I need them at my place. There are none there.
I have been living in this apartment for 6 months, and I'm still not used to this. I think it must stop at some point, and I hope it's while I still have some furniture left. Julia worked at the rental agency I visited when I was looking for a place. She offered to sublet the apartment she'd been living in until her lease ran out. It had been a share house, but everyone was moving. The apartment was much too big for me, but it was in the Old East where I wanted to be, and I could afford it. And it was furnished if, as Julia warned me, only sparsely. This is even truer now. I know Julia is concerned about how long it is taking her to move out, about the steady denuding of the apartment. I have comforted her before, saying all I need is a bed, a desk, a chair, and a coffee pot. I meant it at the time, but 2 days ago, when I found a pile of screwed-up papers and old tissues and cassette wrappers I'd thrown under the desk where the waste paper basket used to be, I thought I must say something to her. Only right now, I'm too tired.
Where have you been? She asks.
Leipzig.
Ah, she says, where it all started.
Julia, I'm sorry, but I'm knackered. I need to go to bed. How about a cup of coffee sometime? Why don't you come over? During the day, I think. She says she will, but we don't make a time because Julia regards fixed appointments as intolerable constraints on her freedom, which may account for how she lit upon this hour of the night for some home renovation. I fall into bed and she continues her nocturnal disassembly so quietly I don't hear a sound when she leaves with the boards and L-hooks and screws balanced in the basket of the bicycle she must have carried down the stairs. In the morning, the first thing I notice is that I can see my breath. One day without heating and the air here congeals with cold. My head is clear, but yesterday feels like a different country. The second thing I notice is that opposite the bed, where there were two blue milk crates that served as a bedside table come dressing stool, is a freshly exposed piece of brown linoleum. When I moved in, I was pleased by the sparseness of the place. I had two bedrooms, a huge living room with windows at tree height looking into the park, and a kitchen on the other side looking over the yard. This apartment was converted under the communists into a place of concrete render on the outside, and on the inside, practical lino brownness, washed and waxed and charmless. But it was summer then, and to me it was a place of air and light with green on both sides. I soon realized everything here was either broken or about to be. Each item had started life as a utilitarian piece of furniture in an Eastern home well over a decade ago. After the wall fell, the students had moved in, and nothing that remains was good enough even for them to take when they left. The couch in the living room has developed lumps and is covered in a dark cloth I fear to disturb. The cord for the kitchen blind is permanently tethered to a plastic chair in order to stop it crashing down. My mattress springs are inching their way through the ticking, and the bathroom, windowless and painted extreme dark green, has plumbing that needed to be learnt. In the hallway, Julia has left a tin bucket full of coal. She must have gone down last night to the pitch-dark cellar to fill it. I feed firelighters and coal into the brown-tiled heater. Although it'll take hours to heat up, her kindness warms me already. I don't really hold it against Julia that she comes to take this flotsam from here. I know she has nothing better where she is now, a one-roomer at the back of a block not far away. I know that in summer the smells from the garbage bins in her yard rise up to her, almost visible. I know that year-round her neighbours are unfriendly, both to each other and within their households, and that she hears their squabbling as it reverberates around the yard. I know that she needs to be alone, but suffers from it too, and that her room is choked with cheap and broken things she feels she may want at some point in life, but may not be able to afford if she abandons. And I know that her small cat is incontinent, which makes her place smell, somehow, of anxiety. So I cannot resent it if she still has keys and comes back to her old life every now and again. I accustom myself to each unexpected absence, the rubber bath mat, the coffee machine, and now the milk crates. I acclimatize to the thinning of the atmosphere. I wear dust-free tracks on the linoleum from kitchen to desk, from bathroom to bed. All I feel today, in fact, as I pass where the bookshelf used to be in the hall, is the sudden predominance of linoleum in my life. Altogether, I can count 5 kinds of linoleum in this once grand apartment, and they are all, each one of them, brown. Degrees of brown. Dark in the hallway, fleck in my bedroom, a brown in the other bedroom that may once have been another colour before succumbing to house rule, brown beige in the kitchen, and my favourite, imitation parquetry in lino in the living room. In the kitchen, I make coffee directly in the thermos. What surprises me about living here is that, no matter how much is taken out, this linoleum palace continues to contain all the necessities for life, at the same time as it refuses to admit a single thing, either accidentally or arranged, of beauty or joy. In this, I think, it is much like East Germany itself. I take my cup to the living room window. In the park there is snow on the ground and the trees, light on light. My breath mixes with coffee steam on the glass. I wipe it away. In the distance lies the city, the television tower at Alexanderplatz like an oversized Christmas bauble blinking blue. I can't see it, but I know that just near there, on the site of the old palace of the Prussian kings pulled down by the communists, is the parliament building of the GDR, the Palace der Republik. It is brown and plastic-looking, full of asbestos and all shut up. It is not clear whether the fence around it is to protect it from people who would like to express what they thought of the regime, or to protect the people from the palace for health reasons. The structure is one long rectangular metal frame, made up of smaller rectangles of brown tinted mirror glass. When you look at it, you can't see in. Instead, the outside world and everything in it is reflected in a bent and brown way. In there, dreams were turned into words, decisions made, announcements applauded, back slapped. In there could be a whole other world. Time could warp, and you could disappear. Like so many things here, no one can decide whether to make the Palace der Republik into a memorial warning from the past, or to get rid of it altogether and go into the future, unburdened of everything except the risk of doing it all again. Nearby, Hitler's bunker has been uncovered in building works. No one could decide about that either. A memorial could become a shrine for neo-Nazis, but to erase it altogether might signal forgetting or denial. In the end, the bunker was reburied just as it was. The mayor said perhaps in another 50 years people would be able to decide what to do, to remember or forget, which is healthier, to demolish it or to fence it off, to dig it up or leave it lie in the ground. Between the Palace der Republik and my apartment lies the neighbourhood of Mitte, the old centre of Berlin, with its grey buildings and white sky and naked trees. streets near here are being renamed, from Marx Engelsplatz to Schlossplatz, from Lenin Allee to Landsberger Allee, from Wilhelm Pieckstrasse to Torstrasse, in a massive act of ideological redecoration. Most of the buildings, though, are not yet renovated. They have largely lost their plaster and are scraped back to patches of brick. They look like tattered faces after plastic surgery. They are as they were before the wall fell, except for the sprouting of domestic-sized satellite dishes from the window frames, a sudden white fungus tuned to outer space. The trams are western now. They were among the first things to cross over here after the wall came down. They are a flash of sighing yellow suspended from strings, shifting through this greyscape. A tram stops right outside my apartment. It obeys a set of lights here under the window, though on the other side of the street there are none to match. I see the driver has the tabloid, screaming red and black headlines, on the control dash. Behind him sit tired-looking people for whom this day has come too soon. I cannot fathom why these lights make the tram halt under my window. The stop itself is half a block away at the corner. Right here, the doors never open for passengers. They just sit, arrested and accepting. It is odd, the sight of a tram with a row of cars behind it, stopped here for no pedestrians, no passengers, no reason, while on the other side vehicles continue unimpeded up the hill into Prenzlauer Berg. The lights change and the driver, still looking at the paper, moves a lever and slides the tram into action. I go out for the paper and bread and walk through the park. In summer this park is festooned with motley groups of drunks and punks. In winter the punks claim the underground stations for warmth, while the drunks install themselves in tram shelters. Today the corner stop is occupied by an old man with a mane of matted locks, a huge felt beard and flowing black robes. His belongings, in plastic bags around him, double as pillows. He is timeless and grand, like someone walked in from another century. A winter king. As passengers alight from trams, he acknowledges them as if they were supplicants paying their respects to his throne, nodding to each and waving them on their way. I cross to the bakery past a billboard that reads, "Advertising makes better known." My baker holds, to some extent, with tradition. He makes whole grain and rye and country loaves, stacked as oblong bricks on the back wall. But now, freed of state-run constraints on his ingenuity, he appears to be conducting his own personal experiment in bestsellerdom. On the left-hand side, under the glass counter, are the baked goods, iced doughnuts and cheesecake and blueberry crumble. On the other side, also under the glass and laid out just as neatly, is a bewildering assortment of fat paperbacks with embossed titles. I am served by a woman with a bad perm. She's wearing a T-shirt which has a lion's face on it. The lion has winking sequins for eyes placed exactly where her nipples must be. I buy half a loaf of rye and ask no questions about the books. When I reach my building, I see that the Winter King has crossed here to the place where the tram stops for no reason. He waits, but no passengers emerge for him to receive. Instead, as I approach, he turns to me and bows, long and dangerously low. Over the next week, I think about Miriam, and I think about Stasi men. I am curious about what it must have been like to be on the inside of the firm, and then to have that world and your place in it disappear. I draft an advertisement and fax it to the personal columns of the Potsdam paper. Seeking former Stasi officers and unofficial collaborators for interview. Publication in English. Anonymity and discretion guaranteed. Chapter 6. Stasi HQ. The next day the phone calls start very early in the morning. I hadn't thought it through. I hadn't imagined what it would be like to have a series of military types who had lost their power and lost their country call you up at home. I'm asleep. I pick up the phone and say my name.
Yeah? In response to your notice in the Märkische Allgemeine?
Yeah. I fumble for my watch. It is 7:35 a.m.
How much are you paying?
Bitte?
You must understand,
the voice says. I sit up and pull the covers around me. To whom am I speaking?
That doesn't matter for the moment.
The voice is assured.
You must understand that it is very hard for some of us now to get jobs in this new Germany. We are discriminated against and ripped off blind from one minute to another in this capitalismus. But we learn fast. So I ask you, how much are you prepared to pay for my story?
I don't know if I don't know what sort of story it is.
I was IM,
he says. I'm tempted. The IMs were inoffizielle Mitarbeiter, or unofficial collaborators. I know I probably won't find many who will speak to me. They are the most hated people in the new Germany because, unlike the uniformed Stasi officers and administrative staff who went off to their bureaucratic jobs each day, these informers reported on family and friends without them knowing. Moment, bitte, I say, and I put the phone in my lap. I remember Miriam telling me that informers routinely argue that their information didn't harm anyone. But how can they know what it was used for? She asked. It is as if they have all been issued with the same excuses manual. I pick up the receiver and say no. How can I reward informers a second time around? And besides, I don't have the money. The phone keeps ringing. I make a series of assignations with Stasi men, in Berlin, in Potsdam, outside a church, in a parking lot, in a pub, and at their homes. My kitchen overlooks the yard. I often see movement behind the windows of the other apartments. Today in one of them a man stands, staring out absent-mindedly. He is naked. I'm on the telephone and I look away, hoping he has not felt observed. When I turn to put the receiver down, he's still there. For a moment I think he may not have seen me, but then I notice he has pulled the curtain across his penis, where he holds it in a gesture of static modesty, a polyester toga. I need to get out of the house and away from the phone. Outside, the cold is bitter and soggy. There's no wind. It is as if we have all been refrigerated. In the stillness, people trail comets of breath. I catch the underground to the National Stasi headquarters at Normannenstrasse in the suburb of Lichtenberg. The brochure I picked up at the Runde Ecke shows a vast acreage of multi-story buildings covering the space of several city blocks. The picture is taken from the air, and because the buildings fold in at right angles to one another, the complex looks like a gigantic computer chip. From here, the whole seamless, sorry apparatus was run. Stasi HQ. And deep inside this citadel was the office of Erich Milke, the Minister for State Security. On the 7th of November 1990, only months after the citizens of Berlin barricaded this complex, Milke's rooms, including his private quarters, were open to the public as a museum. The Federal Commissioner for the Files of the State Security Service of the former GDR, the Stasi File Authority, has taken control of the files. People come here to read their unauthorized biographies. I see through a window into a room where several men and a woman sit, each at their own small table. They look at pink and dun-colored manila folders and take notes. What mysteries are being solved? Why they didn't get into university, or why they couldn't find a job, or which friend told them about the forbidden Solzhenitsyn in their bookcase. The names of third parties mentioned in the files are crossed out with fat black markers so other people's secrets are not revealed, that Uncle Frank was unfaithful to his wife, that a neighbor was a lush. But you are entitled to know the real names of the Stasi officers and the informers who spied on you. For the moments that I stand there, at least, no one is crying or punching the wall. I make my way to the main building like a rat in a maze. I want to get a sense of the man who ran the place before meeting some of his underlings face to face. The name Milka has now come to mean Stasi. Victims are dubiously honored to find his signature in their files, on plans for someone to be observed, with all available methods, on commands for arrest, for kidnapping, instructions to judges for the length of a prison term, orders for liquidation. The honor is dubious because the currency is low. He signed so many. Milka's apparatus, directed largely against his own countrymen, was 1.5 times as big as the GDR regular army. After the wall fell, the German media called East Germany the most perfected surveillance state of all time. At the end, the Stasi had 97,000 employees, more than enough to oversee a country of 17 million people. But it also had over 173,000 informers among the population. In Hitler's Third Reich, it is estimated that there was one Gestapo agent for every 2,000 citizens, and in Stalin's USSR, there was one KGB agent for every 5,830 people. In the GDR, there was one Stasi officer or informant for every 63 people. If part-time informers are included, some estimates have the ratio as high as one informer for every 6.5 citizens. Everywhere Milka found opposition, he found enemies, and the more enemies he found, the more staff and informers he hired to quell them. Here at Normannenstrasse, 15,000 Stasi bureaucrats worked every day, administering the activities of the Stasi overseas and overseeing domestic surveillance through each of the 14 regional offices in the GDR. Photos show Milka to be a small man with no neck. His eyes are set close together, his cheeks puffy. He has the face and the lisp of a pugilist. He loved to hunt. Footage shows him inspecting a line of deer carcasses as he would a military parade. He loved his medals and wore them pinned over his chest in shiny, noisy rows. He also loved to sing, mainly rousing marches and, of course, the Internationale. It is said that psychopaths, people utterly untroubled by conscience, make supremely effective generals and politicians, and perhaps he was one. He was certainly the most feared man in the GDR, feared by colleagues, feared by party members, feared by workers and the general population.
"We are not immune from the villains among us," he told a gathering of
high-ranking Stasi officers in 1982.
"If I knew of any already, they wouldn't live past tomorrow. Short shrift. It's because I'm a humanist that I am of this view."
And,
"All this blithering about to execute or not to execute, for the death penalty or against, all rot, comrades. Execute, and when necessary, without a court judgment."
Milka was born in 1907, the son of a Berlin Cartwright. At 14, he joined the Communist Youth Organization, and at 18, the party. Through the 1920s and early 1930s, the political situation in Germany was volatile. There were street fights between the communists and the Nazis, and the communists and the police. The 1931 death of a communist in a skirmish in Berlin prompted the party to order revenge. On the 8th of August, at a demonstration at Bulauplatz, Milka and another man killed the local police chief and his offsider by shooting them in the back at point-blank range. Milka fled to Moscow. There he attended the International Lenin School, the elite training ground for communist leaders, and worked with Stalin's secret police, the NKVD. In January 1933, the Nazi Party came to power in Germany. Some of the communists responsible for the Bulauplatz murders were sentenced to death, others to long jail terms. A warrant was issued for his arrest. Milka stayed out of Germany. In the late 1930s, he was active in the Spanish Civil War. By his own account, he was interned in France during World War II. But afterwards, Stalin decorated him with medals for service. It seems clear that from the mid-1930s, wherever he was, Milka was a hatchet man in Stalin's secret service. When the war was over, he returned to the Soviet sector of Berlin, where he was safe from prosecution. He worked in the Internal Affairs Division of the Soviet-run police force. In 1957, Milka engineered a coup against its leader, and then he took over as Minister for State Security. He proceeded to consolidate his power within the party and over the country. In 1971, he helped organize the coup which brought Erich Honecker to power as Secretary General. Honecker awarded Milka with candidacy for the Politburo and a house in the luxurious party compound at Wandlitz. From that time on, the two Erichs ran the country. Milka was an invisible man, but Honecker's picture was everywhere. It was in schools, in free German youth halls, in theatres and over swimming pools. It was at the universities, in police stations, at holiday camps and in the border guards' watchtowers. He always wore a suit and tie, large dark-rimmed glasses, and his hair, first dark, then grey, combed back off a high forehead. Other than being small, Honecker was unremarkable-looking, except for his strange, full-lipped mouth, which seemed to widen only partially for a smile. Honecker's background was not dissimilar from Milka's. His father was a miner, and he joined the Jung Spartacus Bund at 11, and the Communist Youth at 14. He was apprenticed as a roof tiler before spending 1930-31 at the Lenin School in Moscow, then working underground for the communists against the Hitler regime. In 1937, he was arrested by the Gestapo and sentenced to 10 years imprisonment for preparation of high treason. He escaped shortly before the end of the war, when he began steadily to make his career in the party, running East Germany. The Stasi's brief was to be the shield and sword of the Communist Party, called the Socialist Unity Party of Germany, or SED. But its broader remit was to protect the party from the people. It arrested, imprisoned, and interrogated anyone it chose. It inspected all mail in secret rooms above post offices, copying letters and stealing any valuables, and intercepted daily tens of thousands of phone calls. It bugged hotel rooms and spied on diplomats. It ran its own universities, hospitals, elite sports centers, and terrorist training programs for Libyans and the West Germans of the Red Army faction. It pockmarked the countryside with secret bunkers for its members in the event of World War III. Unlike secret services in democratic countries, the Stasi was the mainstay of state power. Without it, and without the threat of Soviet tanks to back it up, the SED regime could not have survived. The foyer of Stasi HQ is a large atrium. Soupy light comes through the windows behind a staircase that zigzags up to the offices. A small woman who reminds me of a hospital orderly, neat hair, sensible white shoes, is showing a tour group around. The visitors are chatty, elderly people who have just got off a bus with Bonn number plates. They wear bright colours and expensive fabrics, and have come to have a look at what would have happened to them had they been born or stayed further east. The group is standing around a model of the complex as the guide tells them what the demonstrators found here on the evening of the 15th of January 1990, when they finally got inside. She says there was an internal supermarket with delicacies unavailable anywhere else in the country. There was a hairdresser with rows of orange helmet-like dryers for all those bristle cuts. There was a shoemaker and, of course, a locksmith. The guide crinkles her nose in order to push her glasses up its bridge, a reflex which doubles as a gesture of distaste. She explains that the neighbouring building, the archive, was invisible from outside the complex, and a copper-lined room had been planned for it to keep information safe from satellite surveillance. There was a munitions depot here, and a bunker underneath for Mielke and a select few in the event of a nuclear catastrophe. She says Berliners used to refer to this place as the House of 1,000 Eyes. I start to look about the atrium. An arrow points towards a library, another up the stairs to an exhibition room. It smells of dust and old air. Then I hear the guide say something about a biological solution. The Westerners are silent. She says instead of waiting for a revolution, she and her friends had pinned their hopes on the old Marxisten-Stenilisten in power dying off. After all, she says, wrinkling her nose, the GDR had the oldest leadership in the world. We have got to have broken some kind of a record there. But unlike in China, where the leaders were wheeled out virtually dead for display, the old men here showed remarkably little sign of physical decay. They were up to it all, she explains. Injecting sheep cells, ultra-high doses of oxygen, you name it. Those blokes wanted to live forever. She starts to talk about the beginning of the end. Mielke and Honecker grew up fighting the real evil of Nazism, and they kept on fighting the West, which they saw as Nazism's successor for 45 years after the war ended. They had to, as a Soviet satellite state and the Eastern Bloc's bulwark against the West. But in East Germany they did so more thoroughly and with more pedantic enthusiasm than the Poles, the Hungarians, the Czechs, or the Russians themselves. They never wanted to stop. When Mikhail Gorbachev came to power in the Soviet Union in 1985, he implemented the policies of perestroika, economic reform, and glasnost, openness of speech. In June 1988, he declared a principle of freedom of choice for governments within the Eastern Bloc and renounced the use of Soviet military force to prop them up. Without Soviet backup to quash popular dissent, as there had been at the workers' uprising in Berlin in 1953, in Hungary in 1956, and in Prague in 1968, the GDR regime could not survive. The options were change or civil war. By comparison with other Eastern Bloc countries, East Germany never had much of a culture of opposition. Perhaps this was in part due to the better standard of living, perhaps to the thoroughness of the Stasi, or, as some put it, to the willingness of Germans to subject themselves to authority. But mostly it was because, alone of all Eastern Bloc countries, East Germany had somewhere to dump people who spoke out. West Germany. It imprisoned them and then sold them to the West for hard currency. The numbers of dissidents could not reach a critical mass until 1989, when the changes in the Soviet Union gave ordinary people courage and they took to the streets. But the men running the GDR were ossified. They were not interested in reform. As late as 1988, they disallowed Soviet films and magazines in an attempt to stop the people being infected with new ideas. And they cracked down, exiling waves of negative enemy elements to West Germany. Miriam's summary expulsion in May 1989 was one of the last of these purges. They couldn't, however, all be thrown out. That would be impractical, and worse, might amount to giving the people the freedom they craved. So, the guide says, the old men had another scheme. They would contain the dissenters at home. Documents found after the wall fell reveal meticulous plans, current throughout the 1980s, for the surveillance, arrest, and incarceration of 85,939 East Germans, listed by name. On day X, the day a crisis, any crisis, was declared, Stasi officers in the 211 local branches were to open sealed envelopes containing the lists of the people in their area to be arrested. The arrests were to be carried out quickly, 840 people every 2 hours. The plans contained exact provisions for the use of all available prisons and camps, and when those were full, for the conversion of other buildings, former Nazi detention centres, schools, hospitals, and factory holiday hostels. Every detail was foreseen, from where the doorbell was located on the house of each person to be arrested, to the adequate supply of barbed wire and the rules of dress and etiquette in the camps. Armbands, green, 2 centimeters wide, for the oldest in the room. Green, 3 stripes, 2 centimeters wide, for the oldest in the camp, yellow with the letters SL in black for the shift leader to be worn on the left upper arm. And there were written instructions for packing to be given upon arrest to each prisoner. 2 pairs socks, 2 towels, 2 handkerchiefs, 2 times underwear, 1 times woolens, 1 times toothbrush and paste, 1 times shoe cleaning gear. Women, in addition, sanitary supplies. They would be locked up indefinitely and for no reason at all, but they would have clean shoes, teeth and underwear. By mid-1989, the demonstrations after Monday prayer meetings at Leipzig's Nikolaikirche were spreading all over the country to Erfurt, Halle, Dresden, Rostock. People were protesting against travel restrictions, shortages of